Good morning, Western Wisconsin. Let's see what we're up to. Hi, everybody. Al Ross, and it's time for Spectrum West here on Wisconsin Public Radio, where today you'll meet the one and only Mr. George Winston. And I mean that literally, not figuratively. He's one of a kind, and you'll hear how when we share a conversation with George, who's out on tour in the Midwest this week, giving people the music for which he's come to be known. Jim Oliver's here with Mitchell Nevin. He's author of Psychic Reprieve, a fictional accounting, some of which occurs in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Greg Rochester is an artist who takes roads less traveled, roads that run through hills and valleys dotted with multicolored spots and swirls, among other hills that look as normal as when we travel Wisconsin roads. He combines his imagination with the real world, including using bicycles as his canvas. And you can see his work on display into January at the L.E. Phillips Memorial Public Library in Eau Claire. And what do you say we christen this Christmas sleigh ride with this? I am not a tough guy, and when it comes to an ability to tear up at something sentimental or something downright beautiful, I am right up there with the best of them. And I don't mind admitting that the musical interpretation of the Master Singers is notorious for causing such a reaction. Their holiday concert is especially that way. The concerts, there's a couple of them, Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls, happen this weekend. They include some special guests. I visited the UW Eau Claire office of Dr. Gary Schwartzhoff, the croon master of these Master Singers. We've talked about membership in the Master Singers before, but I want to talk about the prerequisites that are necessary to be in the Master Singers. This is obviously not just another group where there's people that get together because they love to sing, although you need that. Do people have to know how to read music to be in the Master Singers, or would you look past that for a killer voice?
Well, the reading skills, the musicianship, which that's part of, obviously, vary from individual to individual. I would say if an individual does not read music, it would be unlikely that they probably would be spending time with us. The commitment simply is too great. The pace is too fast. It would probably just go over the top of their head. If the members of the Master Singers were to hear this, some of them would just chuckle, going, well, you know, I don't read particularly well. So it's a skill that everyone works on throughout their entire life as a musician, and I would include myself in that.
So now you mentioned the word commitment. You have a 3-concert season, but you have ancillary performances as well. For the singers, what is their season? When do you start rehearsing, and how often do you rehearse?
We begin in mid-August, around August 20th, with a couple rehearsals before Labor Day, including a retreat on a Saturday for about 6 hours, just kind of to introduce the fall concert and get it rolling quickly in the fall. Yes, that concert happens in early October. And then we continue through this week. We've met every week since then with our concerts this weekend, our 2 here, one in Eau Claire and the other in Chippewa Falls. And then we'll be off for about a month, starting in about January 20th. That'll take us through the end of the year. The year concludes this year with a choral residency on May 9, 10, 11 with Dan Forrest, a composer in Chicago. We're going to do one of his major works entitled Requiem for the Living with him and other singers from other choirs in Chicago to conclude the year.
Tell us about the honor of working with our own Wisconsin Poet Laureate.
Well, as we approach the season, and this was known to us that Max Garland was here in Eau Claire and named Wisconsin's Poet Laureate, it seemed natural to us to approach him about the possibility of writing a text, if you would, for a new Christmas piece. We had several meetings with Max. What he said to us, an exciting option for him, for it's something he had not done before. So we're very pleased when Max agreed to do this. And this collaborative process between him, myself, and the composer in residence, Andy Steffen, led to this piece, which we're going to perform in the concert. There is a gift. I wouldn't call it a poem necessarily, but a seasonal writing, which he did, is the basis of this new composition. Andy Steffen then took the words of Max Garland and studied it, and how did it resonate with him in terms of becoming a musical piece, and chose the majority, not all the text, Max himself will be at the concert on Friday, December 20th, to read the Christmas writing before the piece is performed.
So how long was that process? When was he given the commission to do this?
We met with him early in the summer, so this would be back like in June. Oh, okay. That we approached him about the possibility of doing this, and then I don't know exactly, probably in August, September, he finished his work on it, turning it over to us and therefore Andy Steffen to get the piece written for the choir.
Gary Schwartzoff with us. We're talking about the Master Singers. The holiday concert is called There Is a Gift. So tell us the gifts that the Master Singers are giving us this holiday season.
Well, as we approach this program, it's a number of carols which you certainly have heard before, a number of them, but they're new arrangements for the most part. They're ones that our peers, ensembles like the Master Singers and their conductors who are perhaps arranging, are performing on their concerts, and we have heard their works, done their works over the years. In Dulce Jubilo, for example, by Matthew Culleton, was presented on our concert last year. Matthew has two new settings on the concert for this week, Angels We Have Heard in High and the Austrian Carol Still, 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 as an example. A composer we're working with later this year, Dan Forrest, we're doing his setting of A Christmas Lullaby. And a number of other new carols by composers, Bob Chilcott from England, An Advent Candle, lovely, lovely piece. We're doing a piece by Stephen Paulus from Minneapolis. Stephen Paulus was taken ill this past July 4th, and we're honoring his work in so doing. We're continuing with the Library of Congress project for the promotion of pieces that are no longer in print. We're doing a piece entitled O Holy Child of Bethlehem by George Chadwick, who lived back in the 19th century. We're trying to be part of something greater than us. It's a project with the Library of Congress and the American Choral Directors Association. We send the recordings off to ACDA, and they then are working with Library of Congress to make these pieces recordings available at the Library of Congress. That's a program we've been involved with now for the last 5 years. We think is very exciting. Mm-hmm. The concert will conclude with an arrangement of carols by James Mulholland. He's someone we've done a number of works by. He teaches at Butler University. Carols of Christmas is the name of it. It's accompanied with a brass ensemble and percussion ensemble of 7 players. The piece was scored for piano, and we commissioned James Mulholland to write a brass percussion score that went with it. That's part of this concert as well.
Literally, there are people who say to themselves, and I look out the window and it's snowing now, so I'm in the holiday spirit, who say to themselves, it's not Christmas until you hear the Master Singers. And that's quite a nice testament to what you bring to the holidays.
Well, we love to hear that. We think it's a very special time as well. I mean, the investment that everyone makes into the holiday season in preparation for family and friends coming home and gift-giving, we feel like what we do is a part of that, and we're very pleased to present that here to the greater Chippewa Valley.
Let's talk about venues for a second. When many musical aggregations put on concerts, they talk about the acoustics within the hall. You seem to thrive and even sound more beautiful and angelic when the hall is like, for instance, St. Borromeo Church. You wouldn't say that they have good acoustics, but it's the echo, it's the thing. How is that in choral music? Does the venue matter? Does it enhance you in any way?
Very much so. I mean, the acoustics are a very important property to our performance. I would say that the church in Chippewa Falls, St. Charles Borromeo, is a lovely place to sing. The musician is fed in that environment. That is, hearing the music enhanced, that color coming back to you is something that is very affirming to a choral musician. That, I think, is also the case to a lesser extent. The reverberance isn't as much, but at First Congregational Church, and we've sung other places like annually, we go to St. Mary's Basilica in Minneapolis, and you know, we jokingly say that's our international tour on an afternoon because of how that feeds the musician's soul, that amount of reverberance, echo, if you would, that time delay. Mm-hmm. It's everything. As opposed to when it's a very dry acoustic, you, quite frankly, in a choral ensemble, when the ensemble doesn't hear or is fed to that extent, it's oftentimes very difficult to sing in tune. Choir loses pitch. Well, it's like the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra that comes here and performs in Zorn Arena, and they think the acoustics are wonderful. Now, for choral music, it's not so kind, but they have performed here regularly on the Artist Series, and they speak rather glowingly of Zorn Arena. We're going, really? But again, that's a different medium, and that's the way it works for them. For a choral ensemble, there needs to be that reverberance in the space that feeds the musician's soul.
Gary Schwartzoff, thanks again for hosting us here at your university office. Merry Christmas and happy holidays to you and the Master Singers.
Thank you, L. Ross. Merry Christmas to you.
As people gather, your Christmas gathers momentum and goes where Christmas is meant to go because you witnessed the Master Singers. You have two opportunities this weekend, Friday evening at 7:30 at First Congregational Church in Eau Claire, and then Saturday afternoon at 1 at St. Charles Borromeo Catholic Church in Chippewa Falls. Suddenly, it's really Christmas. You'll see.
Support for WPR comes from Wisconsin Credit Union, offering full real estate services from listing to selling properties. Current listings, mortgage calculator, and other information is online at wisconsinrealty.org. Support also comes from Volume 1 and the Local Store, featuring locally inspired gifts, books, music, apparel, and art. Inside the historic building at 205 North Dewey Street in downtown Eau Claire, or online at volume1.org/store.
Thank you so much. Spectrum West for the 19th day of December. The Janet Carson Gallery at the Eau Claire Regional Art Center in downtown Eau Claire hosts the Holiday Art Fair now through Monday. You can give a kid a book at the Ellie Phillips Public Library in Eau Claire through today. You can bring new unwrapped books to the library or to Charter Bank in Eau Claire. Books a Million is a drop-off point through December 24th. A Menominee holiday tradition returns tonight, Thursday the 19th, as Jim Miller returns with A Child's Christmas in Wales to the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts, 7 o'clock. Info at 233-3034. Well, our special literary and theatrical correspondent Jim Oliver has this Christmas present for us all, a chat with author Mitchell Nevin. And for all he does for Spectrum West week in and week out throughout the year, a big thank you and a hearty season's greetings to Mr. Jim Oliver, good friend of WPR and yours truly. Here's Jim.
Psychic Reprieve, Deception and Reality. It's a book by retired detective Mitchell Nevin. The primary characters include a college baseball player, a disgraced Chicago police officer, and a convicted identity thief who is a whiz at canasta. And a good part of the story is set in Eau Claire, along with Milwaukee and a federal prison camp in Duluth, among other places. Mitchell Nevin joins us to talk about Psychic Reprieve, Deception and Reality, and of his other book that he has written before this one this year. So tell us what the book is about.
Well, Psychic Reprieve, unlike my first book, I tried to show the perception of the criminal justice system from the people that are prosecuted. So what happens is, three characters that you mentioned, more or less they're nonviolent offenders who happen to stumble onto the criminal justice system either because they've done something stupid or kind of got involved in some underhanded activity, but really don't pose much of a threat as far as violence to society. And so what I've done is I've taken these three characters. One is a college baseball player from Milwaukee, and what I try to do is take a focus on hazing pranks in sports and then turn them into an active perspective where people can see how something that is really supposed to be relatively benign and actually wind them up in a whole world full of trouble. And then kind of watch as they go through the system and then understand the concepts that they have once they do get convicted and the obstacles that they need to overcome once they get these convictions.
So how much research did you have to do, and how much did you depend on your law enforcement experience for the book?
Well, a lot of the subplots in the book and some of the actual plots are based on some actual events. The characters are obviously composites of people. So I really drew a lot of my experience as a law enforcement officer as far as the criminal justice process and the court process. But I did do some research as far as the federal court system, what happens when people become incarcerated in the federal system, what different types of prisons are there, and what they can expect to experience when they go into a prison and when they exit the prison as far as trying to, you know, try some gainful employment and things like that.
For those of us who've never been in prison or in jail, the part where the baseball player was taken into a jail for holding purposes before being sent on to a federal prison was pretty violent. Is that typical of what happens to people when they go to jail?
Well, what happens typically is that initially, especially for federal prisoners, they remain in usually a county facility until they're sent to a federal prison camp or a federal prison. And in this instance, the baseball player was incarcerated in Milwaukee and then was transported to Sandstone, Minnesota. There was a layover in Ramsey County, Minnesota, where he spent the night in a detention facility. And of course, once you're in these local detention facilities, all types of characters are present because there's really no screen, as there is in a prison system, to determine who's more violent and who's not violent. The prisoners are more or less thrown together in pods. And because of that, he has interactions there with some people who are rather unsavory and gets to experience kind of the rough side of incarceration his first night.
I was wondering about your ties to Eau Claire. You have a lot of detail in about Eau Claire, the Grand Avenue Business District, Carson Park, the college baseball team. And in your book, they're called the Rail Splitters. We have the Eau Claire Express here. Did you just spend time in Eau Claire, or do you know a lot about the city?
Well, what happens is my publicist is in Eau Claire. And so when I was trying to find a setting for the book, I was trying to find a setting that was unfamiliar to all three characters once they got released from the federal prison camp. And because I was spending time in Eau Claire, speaking to my publicist, I looked around the town and I thought, you know, this would be a perfect setting. They have a baseball team that has a small town environment with a family type environment. People here are very interested in their local restaurants and things of that nature. And that's why I kind of used Eau Claire as a concept. And I spent about maybe 10 days in Eau Claire to really get a flavor for the going-ons. And this was last summer as far as the baseball team, as far as where the mall was located, what people did for occupations. I kind of incorporated that into the overall plot.
He is Mitchell Nevin, who is the author of Psychic Reprieve, Deception and Reality. Well, as you describe in the book, psychics are looked upon with suspicion most of the time. Have you had experience with the paranormal in your law enforcement career?
Yes, I did. When I was with the Milwaukee Police Department, I worked in the Criminal Intelligence Division. There we have contact with lots of different groups. Some of the groups, obviously, are members of the occult. Others are gang members. But some, you know, they'll try to make contact with you because they believe they're experiencing something. They want to pass certain information on to the police. And from my experiences, I don't put too much faith in psychics, although I do believe that there are people out there that have, like, an extra sense, that they can feel something around them. They might feel somebody's presence, and I can't explain it. They've told me things that I know they can't know. There's no way they could have verified it, but I could. And so there's something out there, something I wouldn't call it mystical. I'd just call it kind of like an extra sense that some people might have. And I believe has some credibility to it. Like the title of the book, Deception of Reality, I believe that for every 10 persons out there, 9 are probably very deceptive in their psychic abilities. Maybe one of them there's something to it. There's some clairvoyance there. And that's hence the title of the book. As the characters move through the book, RC, who suffers a beatdown in prison, begins to have some clairvoyant abilities. And what happens is that they market his clairvoyant abilities to make money. And in doing so, they also hire a private detective through some backgrounds and the people they're going to give readings to. So while some of his perceptions of people are legitimate, others are deceptive, and hence the title of the book.
Talk about your other book, The Cozen Protocol. When did that come out?
It was initially published in 2008, it's been republished in 2013 by, was picked up by a mainstream publisher. What that one really does is, well, I describe it as a cop's cop book. Because if you watch what goes on television, you see the local police chief or the public information officer that they have, you see a very kind of sterile environment with the police. Nobody really sees what goes on behind the scenes. And what the Colson Protocol does is it kind of takes a crane or a bulldozer and pulls the veneer off the police building, let people see what goes on inside of a big city police department, more or less how a handful of just bad apples really undermine the mission of a big city police department and throw a lot of rank-and-file officers under the bus along with them.
So when did you start writing?
I started writing realistically just to kind of get a knack of it when I was in the service. I spent some time in the U.S. Navy. We have a lot of downtime. So I took up writing as kind of a hobby. When I got to college, it progressed a little bit, and I began to develop some concepts when I was on working the streets, because you see a lot of colorful characters that I thought would make an interesting novel. Through the years, began to kind of hone my craft, I guess you would say, and to make, be able to make it into a book format.
When did you get the idea that you could actually publish your stuff and people would buy it?
Well, I had to kind of like, I think everybody who writes a book believes it's the best book in the world. You have to.
Sure.
Like anybody else, you have to have some level of confidence that you can do it. But I began bouncing ideas off of some of my colleagues in law enforcement and to get some feedback of what they would think. And so I'd write a couple of chapters and send it around, and I'd take the critiques, good, bad, or otherwise. And the feedback I had from people I know that were brutally honest with me was, hey, you know, you have some ability. Maybe you should kind of move forward with it and see where it goes. It kind of encouraged me and pushed me in the right direction and kind of gave me some guidance on what they thought would work and what they thought wouldn't.
Do you have any authors who you look upon as role models?
Oh, yeah. One of my persons I consider a mentor is a former homicide detective from Milwaukee, Steve Spangola. Steve has written a couple of books. You'll see him sometimes on cable television shows as far as investigating homicides. Probably one of the most knowledgeable detectives I've ever worked with. When I needed information about surveillance or how to conduct certain investigations at homicide scenes or DNA, I could contact Steve as a reference source. But more importantly, as an author, Steve has written these books and has contacts. He more or less mentored me and kind of pushed me in the right direction on where to go to get published.
So what are you working on now?
I'm working on a new book about some disenfranchised veterans that come back from Iraq and Afghanistan, how they come back and their perceptions of what they obviously observed overseas and what they're seeing here when they come home. Typically what happens is I start putting the proverbial pen to paper in January, and hopefully by the end of spring or early summer, I have some type of product to work with. I can go back and make some revisions and self-edit, and then by midsummer, I have something I can send to a publisher to take a look at.
So where are your books available?
Well, my books are available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. They're also available at the local store in downtown Eau Claire and some other local booksellers in the area as well.
Well, the book is Psychic Reprieve, Deception and Reality by Mitchell Nevin. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you, Jim. We appreciate it. This is Spectrum West for the 19th day of December. I'm Al Ross. Congratulations to 7th grader Annalie Higley and 8th grader Megan Cavanaugh for being two of just 36 national finalists in the Crayola Creativity Connects Us art exhibition competition. Their work is on display at the Department of Education in Washington, D.C. Both are students at DeLong Middle School in Eau Claire. I mean, how cool is that? Tell me the first thing that comes to your mind when I say the name George Winston. I can imagine it has something to do with setting a mood, providing a background for some quiet time, maybe even an experience with romantic over or undertones. That's how George Winston made a name for himself. In a world of sound-alikes, he found a niche that no one else seemed to want. He's an extraordinary pianist. His arrangements and how he illuminates familiar pieces until they become all his own are uncanny, and they're genius, actually. George Winston will be back to the State Theater in Eau Claire Friday evening. That's next No, that's Friday evening, the 20th. That is either tomorrow if you're listening Thursday or tonight if you're listening Friday. And rather than me attempt to explain how and why he does his thing, let's hear it from him. We talked with him while on tour, and we began where it began, in Montana, where pianists are vastly outnumbered by cowboys and baseball players, actually.
No, I had a few. Actually, I had a few piano lessons, but I didn't want them. I wanted baseball.
Oh, really?
Baseball was a big, big, big thing in Billings and Miles City also. I mean, baseball was, St. Louis Cardinals minor league team was there, and it was just baseball all the time. So I had a few lessons. You know, I knew where C was or something, but I just wasn't interested. In fact, I didn't even listen to music until I was 12, maybe hearing something on a car radio or
sure.
My dad's 78 once in a while, but it just wasn't part of my life at all. It was just kind of like birds. You know, you see the birds, but they're not. You don't really interact with them.
Sure.
You know? Then I started listening to music winter of 1961. For some reason, I was 12. There was a lot of instrumental hits around that time.
Uh-huh.
In fact, there were 30 top 40 instrumental hits in 1961, so I got really spoiled by that.
I remember reading your bio, and you were talking about instrumental people, and the group The Ventures came up, and I went, wow, you see, that was one of my favorite bands. But
yeah,
cool.
Ventures were my favorite band, and and Booker T and the MGs. That's all I got was instrumental stuff. Taped it off the radio with my dad's tape recorder, and, you know, when the British invasion happened, I led to the adult stations because they were playing instrumentals, you know, Tijuana Brass, Richard Groove Holmes, the jazz organist, and Jimmy Smith, the jazz organist. I didn't go back to the rock radio station until 67. There was just more going on, and it was less commercial. It was a little renaissance area of time period of late 66 through late 68.
You don't get a lot of instrumental music anymore. I mean, I remember the albums that my parents had, and I mean, back then you could listen to Percy Faith, and you could listen to Chris Waxman on the organ, and you could listen to lots of different instrumentalists. That doesn't seem to be the case nowadays.
It got less after 61. I mean, 62, you had Vince Guaraldi's Cast Your Fate to the Wind.
And yeah.
They're there, but the thing about that, what I call that renaissance period, is late 66 to late 68, there were more solos, like The Doors Light My Fire is the best example.
Oh, yeah. So
there were vocal pieces, but there was a lot of instrumental interplay, too, or Jimi Hendrix.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was featured things for guitarists and organists,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so it was instrumental and vocal.
They were all disc jockeys' dreams, having all those long cuts that were 15, 17 minutes.
Yeah. There's stuff going on. You kind of got to look for it. If you look and look and look, you know, there are things everywhere. They're just, you know, fiddle associations, and Montana has that too.
Well, before we label you too narrowly, we should point out that you also play the guitar and you play the harmonica as well. But, I mean, the piano is what comes to mind when people hear that, like, Santa Claus George Winston is coming to town. So let's talk about the pianist. When I heard you were coming to Western Wisconsin, I thought to myself, you know, he's got one of those very unique positions. The way I wrote it, you are the Kenny G or the Michael Bolton of the piano set, because you have a niche there. I mean, I can't think currently who, except maybe the O'Neill brothers that I know of, are slotted in that tranquil piano solo instrumental category. Beginning in the 80s, when you recorded Autumn and Winter into Spring and December and Summer and Forest, I mean, those were the tranquil pieces that I was alluding to. And then, since then, you've broke out a bit. When you started with those pieces for which you became known, which was
the Autumn, yeah.
Which was
1980.
Well, that was the CD that people put on when they wanted to relax, or there was a guy who had a girl coming over, so he lit the candles and he put George Winston on the CD player. Was that how you wanted to start and knew you were going to evolve, or did you just were you just letting the keys fall where they may?
No, I just play what's currently happening, you know. I do think of albums as thematic, so the Autumn tunes all went together in the early winter, December, those tunes. So whatever fits together. And then over time, I see that I'll work on somebody's song or make one up, and I'll say, oh, yeah, it goes in that barrel. So, and then when there's a bunch to pick from, then, okay, do these all fit together to make a statement? Role models for that way of thinking with albums are Vince Guaraldi's Charlie Brown Christmas album, which is like one song with 11 parts, and also The Doors' first album, which is like one song with 11 parts. In fact, I started playing organ. I started playing because I heard the Doors in early 67. I got their album just because, you know, I was a freak for instrumentals, and particularly organ. So I got the album. They weren't known outside L.A. at the time, I learned later.
True.
I just got the album because it said they had an organist. And I took it home, and I put it on, and I went, this is like the greatest thing I ever heard. I got to get an organ and play in a band.
So I think
the one that spurred me to become a player instead of a listener.
Yeah, that guy Ray,
he
just passed away, didn't he?
Yeah, very recently. He was sick for a while, and he was a good friend of mine. And, you know, I got to know him when I did that album of Doors songs called Night Divides the Day, the music of the Doors.
I trekked over to San Francisco in 2007 for the 40th anniversary of the Summer of Love concert.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He played at that.
Yeah.
He played.
I was out of town. I live Santa Cruz, but I'm in that area occasionally when I'm home. But, yeah, I remember that event.
That was a lot of fun. George Winston is on the phone with us here on Spectrum West. He's coming to the State Theater in Eau Claire on Friday, the 20th of December. You have, George, a summer concert series and a winter concert series. How do they differ?
Well, this will be the winter show. Mm-hmm. I do try to alternate each time I play someplace, and then the shows change over time as well. So the winter show is basically fall and winter things that I regard as fall or winter tunes. Growing up in Montana, it's like the seasons are very distinct,
yeah.
Even more so in Montana. And so I just grew up thinking in seasons like you think in English. If you grow up in America, you speak in English, you don't even think about it.
Right.
I don't even think what's a verb or what's the word for cat. It's just there. And it was the same thing. I just thought of everything in terms of the season, mm-hmm. including songs. And to this day, when I hear a song that I'm interested in listening to or playing, it's a season. It's got a season and a picture, and the topographies and the seasons are the two sides of the same coin. A season has to be someplace. Someplace has to be in a season. So I just think of music in that way, much, much more than what part of the world is this from. You know, is this folk or, you know, is this jazz? I mean, I think of that's a spring song.
Let's say you say to yourself, yeah, I've got to write another winter song. Does it just kind of flow for you, or is it kind of an arduous task to make sure that at the end of it, it reminds you or anybody else of winter?
Well, I never try to compose anything. It just happens once in a while. Most of them kind of melt away pretty quick. Basically, I'm always just like working on the piano, working on songs I'm trying to play better, and once in a while, something will kind of emerge, and I'll go, yeah, you know, it reminds me of this, and I'll write down the chords. I'll see if it stays around. If it does, fine. If it doesn't, fine.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
I'm really kind of neutral about it. I don't really have the temperament of a composer. I frankly don't know how people do that. Sit down and I'm going to write a song. I couldn't do it.
No.
If I did, it wouldn't be very good.
No.
but once in a while, something happens, and it stays around, and it's got a season and a picture, and again, it's a very neutral thing to me. It's not bad if the song doesn't stay around. I mean, there's other things to work on. But I admire people that do compose a lot, you know.
Well, that's a nice perspective to have, though. I mean, the way you look at it, it's music is just part of your nature and who you are, and you don't get upset. Moderation in all things, including music.
Well, I'm always just trying to get it better. I mean, there's certainly things I wish I could have done better. So that's really in the performance of it where my attention is. That's what practice is about, too. You know,
yeah.
If you're not in the zone particularly, you can still get the meaning of the song across. And that's really all it's about anyway. It's a very subjective thing. I've played shows I didn't like at all, and then I heard a recording later and go, what's so bad about that?
Yeah.
You know, or I've heard shows I felt good, I was inspired, I thought I was playing well. I listened back and there's too much going on, too many notes, too much stuff. It's not good. I thought it was good. Making recordings is hard because how do you know? Well, oh, time will tell. You know, if I still like something in a few months, okay, it's probably okay.
But so when you're on stage and you're playing, are you many times just ad-libbing because you know the piece or the feeling so well?
It depends on the song. Some songs have more of a space for improv than others. There's always some variation because the journey to the town and the concert is all kind of one journey. The beginning of the journey is leaving the previous hotel, and the end of the journey is the end of the concert. So it's all that getting there and the topography and the scenery, getting on the way, and then the feeling of the next town, that's all part of the music. So songs do change a bit depending on where I am and the journey getting there.
Wow.
And that's what I need. I need lots and lots and lots and lots of topographical inspiration to keep the songs alive and keep everything going.
Sounds as if you interpret life itself musically.
Yeah, it is life itself and the earth and the season. You know, it's if I was a photographer, I would photograph places and the seasons, you know, or photograph the same place in all four seasons. Or if I was a painter, I would paint, you know, fall scenes or something like that. So it really is, yes, you're exactly right. It really is an expression of something else.
You've also chosen to produce music for the benefit of some pretty worthy causes, and that's admirable. Tell me about those efforts. Is that something you just feel like you have to do?
I just want to, you know, just after 9/11 happened, everybody wanted to help some way, and so I did an EP called Remembrance, benefiting children who are traumatized. It's Children's Aid Society. It's a group in New York City. And after the Katrina, I did an album called Gulf Coast Blues and Impressions, a hurricane relief benefit. There's a group there called Common Ground that's helping people to rebuild and return. And after the oil spill, Gulf Coast Blues and Impressions, Volume 2, Louisiana Wetlands benefit. And then recently, after the food stamps cuts started happening in November this year, I've done a benefit single, Silent Night, digital only, and it benefits Feeding America, a food bank organization I've worked with for many years. In fact, we always have a food bank at the concert. We ask people to bring cans of food, and then they get all the money from the merchandising.
Hmm.
In Eau Claire, the food bank organization is called Feed My People.
Yep. Very active group. You're making kind of a nice little Wisconsin sweep. I see Eau Claire is the last stop. You're going to Green Lake, Viroqua, Milwaukee, and then Eau Claire. That's kind of nice.
Oh, it's great to be back in Wisconsin.
I think it's perfect to go see George Winston play the piano this time of year, not only the holiday part of it, but the seasons are in repose, and it's quiet, and it's cold, and, you know, I don't think of anything that can warm you up better than some George Winston music.
Cold? It's not cold. I came from Billings, Montana before here. It was 17 below, and it warmed up the next day to 16 below, so I just feel like it's spring.
Let's see. You're playing on the 20th, and the next day is the shortest day of the year, and after that, we're heading towards spring. The days get longer. So you're kind of the beginning of good stuff for us.
Yeah, spring always comes. It's just be patient.
Well, George, thanks so much. It's been a pleasure talking to you. I've always wondered what kind of a guy you were because I've enjoyed your music a lot. You're very unique in that sense, and I find out that you're very unique as a human being as well as a musician, too. So thanks for being with us on Spectrum West. I appreciate it.
Well, Al, thanks. My pleasure, and we'll do it again sometime. Thanks for everything.
So now you think you have an impression of who George Winston is. Well, if that motion is founded on a couple quiet CDs you've had and enjoyed over the years, it's time you met the guy we just got to know, the man who just plays it like he feels it. Tell me if this version of Silent Night is what you expected from George Winston. George Winston, Friday night. That's tomorrow if you're listening on Thursday. Tonight if you're catching us on Friday. It's at the State Theater in Eau Claire. Tickets at the door. Give yourself and someone special a Christmas present. Hey, that's him playing Silent Night as he feels it, isn't it?
Here's what's on stage in Western Wisconsin theater venues. A Christmas Story plays through Sunday at the Festival Theater in St. Croix Falls. The show runs weekends through December 29th. Don't Hug Me Christmas Carol plays Friday and Saturday at the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater in Hudson. The show runs weekends through January the 4th. And A Carol of a Christmas will play weekends and selected weekdays at Fanny Hill Dinner Theater in Eau Claire. The show runs through January 12th. And that's some of what's happening in live theater around the region. I'm Jim Oliver.
Support for WPR comes from Heritage Builders in Menominee, dedicated to the design and construction of energy-efficient additions and remodeling projects, specializing in structural air sealing and energy conservation. 235-7910.
Spectrum West, so nice to have you along. Anthony Caporelli is the guest soloist at the University of Wisconsin River Falls, 3 p.m. Saturday, in Abbott Concert Hall of the Kleinpell Fine Arts Building. The concert's free and open to the public. For more information, you could call 715-410-7416. That's 715-410-7416. The annual Barney Awards Banquet's going to be held Friday, January 3rd, recognizing actors for outstanding performances in 2013 and volunteers for assistance above and beyond the call. It's at Lehman Supper Club. Reservations at 234-8897. Well, Greg Rochester is a visual artist who lives in Amory. He paints things, meaning not his subjects necessarily, but the surfaces on which he paints. They include bicycles. And there's an exhibit currently posted through January 7th at the L.E. Phillips Memorial Public Library in Eau Claire. We talked with Greg. Your secondary education centered around English and psychology, I read. Graduate work was in clinical psychology. We can talk about how smart that was in a bit. But your first artistic dabbles, I also read, were in clothing design.
Right. Well, I started doing hand-painted clothing in a number of different kinds of garments. The mainstay that developed out of that was various designs for the Coldwater Creek Company.
Sure.
Catalog. One of the shirts that I designed for Coldwater Creek that was very, very popular was a design that had three moose bodies on it with a moon behind, and then inside the bodies of the moose was the night sky. Kind of picture that?
I can. Yes, I have my eyes closed. I can picture it. In fact, I want one. I want a shirt.
You
like
want
that.
One? Okay.
Were you able to get those things? Do you walk around in those kind of clothes yet?
Oh, yes, I do. I wear some of my, you know. In fact, once in a while, I still paint something that I like, but it's something just for myself, for
sure.
Family or something like that. For a while, I actually did portraits.
Hmm.
People would commission me to do a portrait of their grandchild on a shirt or something
Wow.
like that. You know,
I would be all nervous about how it would last.
It lasts quite well. The painting will outlast the fabric.
No kidding.
I use a special fabric paint, which is really just an acrylic paint with a medium mixed into it.
So it basically just dyes the fabric while you're painting?
It does, yeah. Okay. It soaks all the way through the garment. You know, unlike when you think of a screen-printed
sure.
type of design, it just kind of sits on top.
Yeah.
This will permeate the fabric, so it's quite permanent, yeah.
Well, I don't know why we're spending so much time on this, because you don't do it anymore. But hey, it's fun. It's fun to talk about.
But it is the way that what got me started.
Yes,
that's what I started with.
And
I called my mother, who is also was an artist. She finally said, "You know, I think it's about time that you move to canvases."
So let's go.
I did.
Let's dive.
And then bicycles.
Yes. Wow. What a segue that stuff is.
Yeah.
So let's dive back to the education, because
okay.
I thought about this, just so you know, I figured you out.
Right? Okay.
I think you simply thought it was smart to have a background in psychology so that you could self-analyze and self-treat the pained artist that you had heard happens to most artistic types. So you simply prepared yourself with a background.
Well, you know, I'll tell you what I say when people ask me about it, because I did practice for over 20 years.
Oh, you did? Okay.
But I just said, I was a psychologist. When I finally got well, I became a painter.
Yeah, okay.
I really didn't do that consciously, but it works for me. It's okay.
On the phone with us, Greg Rochester lives in Amory, Wisconsin. Les Tours d'Art at Ellie Phillips Memorial Public Library in Eau Claire. It's been other places, too. We'll get to that. Still considering your education in English and psychology, Greg. You mentioned a moment or two ago your mother, who was also, as you said, a painter. She encouraged you to pursue art, and I wonder how much you believe in artistic genetics. I mean, did you feel you had some transmitted talent inside waiting to realize itself back then?
That's a very good question. Yes, because my grandfather was also a painter.
Oh, wow, there you go.
And I think I had some creative drive, but I put most of it into music until I was about 40 years old and then tried my hand at the visual arts.
Many of your paintings, as I was looking through them in your galleries on your website, they look difficult. They look intricate. One that I wrote here is Lost in Love. That's one where I think to myself, lots and lots of blades of some growing thing that's overlapped and intertwined and multicolored. I'm imagining that to be more of a puzzle than a project because there were so many layers and levels. Is that how you see the stuff before you begin, or do they simply evolve as you go, like that one, for instance?
There's probably some of both of that, but you're correct in that my paintings do contain many, many layers. I paint with very thin layers of oil paint, and that tends to bring a lot of luminosity out of the painting, and but I do see some of it beforehand, and then some of it evolves as well when I'm working.
Mm-hmm. I do encourage people to go to your website and look at Lost in Love as an example. Look at them all, obviously. But that's the one that caught my eye. I kept saying, Wow, how do you know if you're painting that one and you have all those levels and you have all those different colors and blades and they're arcing in all different ways? How do you know when you're done?
I know pretty much when I'm so sick of it that I can't look at it anymore.
Well, that's fair. So let's talk about Les Tours d'Art, which I took French. I should probably try to get the accent going, but I can't. I see that exhibit has toured other places, some faraway places, in addition to now it's in Eau Claire.
Yes, it's been to several different places in the United States. And next summer is going to be touring in Europe.
Let's talk about that exhibit as it materialized. The bikes, man, that's a whole separate subject. For those of you listening who don't know Greg's work, he also paints bikes, expensive bikes, racing bikes, touring bikes. How did painting bikes start for you?
I started out my painting career painting clothing, and that included all kinds of styles of clothing as well as shoes. So there was always something going on in me about painting things that aren't typically painted. And I've been an avid cyclist for some time, and I bought a very nice bike to use as a commuting bike to my job some years ago, and just on a whim, I thought it would be fun to paint it. And it just got started from there, and now I have eight.
Those are all your bikes?
Those are all mine,
By the way, since you mentioned it, I'd like you to paint me a pair of shoes.
Okay.
I think that would be fun. I need something unique like that.
Sandals really lend themselves nicely for painting, too.
Well, they do. Okay. I'll figure something. Maybe some wingtips. You can go nuts with a pair of those.
Yeah.
See, and you know what? What's weird? There's people out there now listening, young people, who have no idea what wingtips are.
I've seen, though, that they look like they're making a comeback a little bit.
Good, because I love them. I think they're cool. Anyway, did you ever paint bikes in reflective paint?
No.
No? There's no such thing as buying reflective paint in all these different colors? Because can you imagine what that would look like going down the street?
That would be pretty spectacular, wouldn't it?
Oh, my. What is in the exhibit at the library? Now, it's not just bikes.
Right. There's basically three things that are in this show. There are the eight bicycles. Each has its own theme. There are also fantasy landscapes that are kind of from the bicyclist's point of view. And then the third is that there are abstracts that have bicycle themes in them.
Mm-hmm. Those landscapes are interesting. I mean, they look kind of Dr. Seussy.
Mm-hmm.
Where do those come from? Because the hills, the rolling hills, are all different designs. How do you, is that something you see?
They are inspired a lot by the Wisconsin landscape. I came from South Dakota, where course, it's very flat. Uh-huh. And when I moved to Wisconsin, I was really struck by the nice rolling hills, not mountains, but just rolling hills. And I got some ideas from that and then elaborated and kind of wove my own feelings and mm-hmm. colors and designs into them. One of the things that's kind of fun, too, is when you go up the stairs yep. where the show is, there's one bicycle and one painting there that's kind of in that stairwell. But when you go up the stairs and in that well, there's a huge, like, 10-foot painting of a bicycle there that I think you'd enjoy looking at. But the show is very, very nice, and John Thorpe did a super job of helping to set it up and hang it. And
yeah, he's good at what he does.
Yes, he is. We do a lot of work together.
It's very unique stuff, very interesting. You're an interesting guy, and we look forward to seeing all your work as it comes out in years to come. Greg Rochester, thanks for being with us again here on Spectrum West.
Thank you, Al.
Sometimes it's nicer to talk to the artist first and then have it stimulate your appetite to see it, which I'm going to do. At the L.A. Phillips Library in Eau Claire, tell you what, I'll meet you there. Just give me a time and we'll experience it together. All the great examples I talked about are at gregrochesterart.homestead.com. Let's see, Spectrum Memos at the Always Happen in Phipps Center in Hudson. There's a holiday concert on the Wurlitzer organ Saturday afternoon at 2 featuring Jelani Eddington, Sunday the 28th at the Heidi Center in Chippewa Falls. Tenor Jacob Christopher returns and performs at 2 p.m. And New Year's Eve, Tuesday the 31st, 7:30 to 10:30, it's the Prelude to an Eve featuring the Troppo Big Band Jazz Ensemble, with whom you can dance your way into 2014. That's cool. Well, let's see, no program next Thursday or Friday. You'll hear a replay of the Big River Radio Wave Holiday Show, which airs originally at 6 p.m. on Christmas Eve on all Ideas Network stations in Wisconsin. It airs again at 10 a.m. Thursday on your Western Wisconsin Ideas Net stations, and then Friday evening at 7 on the news and classical music stations here in the Christmas Chippewa Valley. Thanks, Tiffany Coggins, Rachel Vick, Rich Kramer for the favor, Dean Collenbach for the smooth weekly ride, Jim Oliver, and to you guys out there who make Spectrum West worth doing. Thanks for being here and for your input. I will see you next year as Spectrum West dives into 2014. We'll be here each Thursday morning and Friday evening. Hope you will be too. Merry Christmas, and hey, give a gift of the arts to yourself and to others every chance you get. See ya.